This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey everybody, I'm here to spread a little holiday cheer to each and every one of you. Today's guest is Sean Harris, lead vocalist for the Oakland, California band, The Matches. Together, Sean and I break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind their 2003 single, December is for Cynics, taken from the compilation album, A Santa Cause, It's a Punk Rock Christmas. It was awesome catching up with Sean. We last saw each other around 15 years ago while on tour together, and it was like we didn't miss a beat, picking up right where we left off. He shares the story of working at a brand new studio with a new producer, and how this helped shape the overall vibe of the song. I'm not even sure Sean realized how many different parts and layers were going on in this song until I started dissecting it. It takes you on a ride from note one until the end. The lyrics are cynical and admittedly pompous in parts, which I feel give the song a charm all its own. And how do you go from talking about ugly holiday sweaters and mocking people singing Christmas carols to referencing John Lennon's ghost and backwards messages from the Beatles? Well, somehow The Matches did. For all this and a bottle of NyQuil, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
What's up, Sean?
Hi, Chris.
It's been a minute.
Yeah, I think maybe we last played a show in San Francisco at a venue that's I don't think exists anymore.
Yeah, and would that have been around 06, 07?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And who were we on the road with? I know we did, it was a tour together. I don't think it was a one-off show, was it? It was a couple shows, I thought.
Yeah, I think it was a few shows. Was it Goldfinger? Did we do a few shows with Goldfinger?
Man, it's so many moons ago.
Between us? I don't even remember. Yeah. Anyway.
But we have played together. We have history. And how are you? What's been going on?
Since 2007.
Since I last talked to you.
Let's go. Yeah, let's do the rundown by the year.
You got 1 minute condensed version, then we'll jump in here.
All right, let's go. The Matches went on hiatus. I moved to Australia, where they still had record deals. This is when everything went to streaming. Signed a record deal over there with a band called Maniac. Came back here, got married, moved into an Airstream for 2.5 years. Traveled around the country in that, looking for where we wanted to live, me and my wife and my dog. And then ended up in Joshua Tree. The Matches did a reunion, moved up back kind of close to home in the Bay Area where I live now in Half Moon Bay.
20 seconds
left. It put out, started five bands since then, but the Matches are still, if I ever want anybody to actually listen to what I'm doing, still get together with them once in a while. That's it.
That's awesome, man. So you are in California now.
Yes.
awesome. Well, that was I don't know if I could have done the last 14 years that quickly. Good job.
It's been pretty boring. So
Well, I want to give the listeners a little backstory on you guys, and then I want to say a couple things about your band and about you in particular. The Matches formed in Oakland, California in 1997. Their debut album, Yvonne Dahl Killed the Locals, was self-released in 2003 and then re-released on Epitaph Records when they signed the following year. So my trusted producer, Chris Ophelios, had written in the notes, this is around the first time that he personally heard the matches, because Punchline, Chris's band, was on a comp with you guys called A Santa Cause. It's a punk rock Christmas that was released by Immortal Records in 2003. I believe Immortal was a Epic Records imprint. The comp also had Blink-182, Newfound Glory, The Boss Tones, MXPX, Acceptance, Fall Out Boy, and a bunch of other bands. But the Matches song stuck out to Chris because it was so unique. And to this day, it's his personal favorite Christmas song, which is the song that we are going to talk about today, which is December Is for Cynics. Your second album, Decomposer, came out in 2006. The album was recorded in various studios with 9 different producers. That's insane. Including Mark Hoppus, Brett Gurewitz, Nick Hexum, John Feldman, and Tim Armstrong. That record peaked at number 18 on the Billboard's Independent Albums chart. And you guys did a bunch of touring in support of the record, including several tours of Australia, Europe, 3 Warp tours. And it was around that time that we had hooked up and done some shows Less Than Jake with the Matches. Yep. The band released a band and Hope in 2008, which was once again a collaboration with several different producers. And then, as you said, you guys went on hiatus around 2009, but have reunited several times for shows and tours to celebrate anniversaries of your albums. And something really cool that Chris had told me about recently was there was a documentary about the band called Bleeding Audio. I have not seen it yet. I've been meaning to tune in. It premiered at film festivals in 2020, and Chris said that it's awesome.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's kind of harrowing watching yourself on a big screen in front of people. We went to 2 premieres. It kind of like bookended the stay-at-home orders from the pandemic. Like, the very last thing that we did was play the premiere in San Diego and then just like stayed home for a year and a half. And then we recently went to a follow-up in-person premiere at the Man's Chinese down in Grauman's Chinese down in theater down in Los Angeles. So that was a weird span where it's kind of still premiering because of this weird rollout. But
and how did that come about? Was this something that the band had spearheaded, or was this like a super fan that came and said, "Hey, I want to do a documentary. I love your band."
Kind of somewhere in between. There was a filmmaker who shot us she was like a student filmmaker back in the early 2000s. She shot like a mini doc about the band. And actually, as it turned out, she ended up dating and then marrying our bass player. So she's great. Her name's Chelsea Krister.
Keeping it in the family.
Yeah, she's great. But she has all the access that she wants at this point. She married into the access. But she was kind of shooting that stuff before then.
I would say so. And. And have you found it's so interesting because you guys have reunited and done some reunions and whatnot, but and you celebrate some anniversaries of albums, but have you found that the documentary has kind of brought forth some new fans that maybe hadn't heard you the first go around?
Definitely. I mean, during the premieres, the audiences were kind of at the festivals, the audiences were kind of split, like Matches fans and just sort of people that were there for the film festival. So it was funny being introduced to not grown-up kids. I mean, I guess we're all grown-up kids, but you could definitely spot the sides of the room. It was almost like going to a sports event where like half of the crowd is wearing one set of color and the other half is wearing another colorway. You could like really see who had been to Warp Tour before and who hadn't.
It's funny you should say that because I played a festival recently where I looked out in the audience. I'm like, man, these people look old. And then I said to myself, if they look that old to me, how old do I look to them? Because they're younger than me. I'm like, damn it. I remember the time period well when you guys got signed. You know, we were doing a record out in L.A. and Brett Gurewitz is really good friends with Rob Cavallo, who was doing our record. And I remember when Brett signed you, I remember him telling me, he said, "This is the best band I've ever signed." And I've told people over the years, and I'm going to choose my words carefully here because I don't. This is just my opinion, but I don't say it to make you feel like the coulda, woulda, shoulda been. But your band was amazing. You in particular. I told people there's an it factor. There's a star factor, and you had it. You have it. You know. When you would hit the stage and you were a great front man, the band was great. You guys were all rippers. And, it was, I've talked about your band over the years, probably I don't know. I got three or four bands that I just think that that should have had more success, whatever your definition of success is. But I think you guys should have been way more well known. Just an amazing band.
That's very nice of you to say. Thank you. I'm definitely the worst musician in the band. So I guess that if I'm giving away my secrets, that's what it is.
What do you think it was with you guys? Because I kind of have a theory. I almost feel like, you know, you were somewhere between you had enough. And I hate using this as a generic term, but you had enough pop punk about you to kind of be included in that world. But yet you were just a little bit too avant-garde for those folks. Your approach to your rhythms, and just this track in particular, is just all over the place. It's insane. This song has so much to talk about, you know, and I feel like you may have been a little highbrow for some people.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I'm just like in general a music fan. We would go to Warped Tour and then like the next night, like go see like Michael Manring play jazz bass at Yoshi's or whatever. Like we would, like, we were equal parts like Warped Tour kids and just fans of any music we could get our hands on. So I think that kind of showed itself through the music, but you can't do it alone. So we got enough support from the punk rock community to, like, you know, get the Epitaph deal and to go on tour with a lot of amazing bands from the scene. But then, like, you know, I think we were also eclectic enough to, like, make sense on tour with ska bands, some metal bands, some screamo bands, some pop punk bands. So we kind of got to split the difference and, like, do all the tours. We didn't really make sense perfectly on any tour we ever did, but but we did get to tour a lot, which was fun, and we got to meet a lot of great people, and I love every genre, so yeah.
Well, and it's cool that you used the word jazz a moment ago to describe, because there are jazz elements within this song. There's a part in this track that's just, it's so above what my band or a lot of the bands were doing back then. Just the level of musicianship with your band it's incredible, you know. And this song, I gotta ask, who produced this track? Because I couldn't find it online, because this song is not on any of your records. It's considered a Christmas song, because it was on that comp, but this is anything but a Christmas song to me, or a holiday song. This song could have fit in nicely on a record. Who was the producer, and what was the reason for not including it on a full-length record? Because this song's amazing.
Yeah, this one was produced by Mike Green. Some of his, like, most well-known stuff. He did a bunch of stuff for Paramore back in the day. He did All Time Low. Look him up. You'll find a bunch of records you recognize. He was a guy in a local band in the Bay Area. They were called the Stonecutters, which I think is a Simpsons reference. And he was just this, like, this savant, incredible lead guitar player in kind of a mediocre local band. But he was also a studio nerd and just, like, had all this gear and was really eager to experiment with it. So we recorded half of our first record, Yvonne Dahl Killed the Locals, with him. We actually, and he produced some songs on all three of our records. So yeah, we kind of had an ongoing production relationship with him. Even when we started working with other producers, he was becoming a bigger name producer at the time himself, and he still does it to this day.
So you guys as a band kind of just felt that this track was just going to be beyond the comp. It wasn't worthy, or you didn't want to include it on a record, or?
We got asked to do it for the comp, and as I recall, some of the songs on the comp I think a lot of them were covers. Some of them were originals. It was the option of, like, anything kind of Christmas or New Year's related, or Hanukkah related, or whatever, you know, that part of the season related. Feel free to, like, throw your hat in the ring. And yeah, we heard some of the other bands that were going to be included, and we were like, I think this is worth, like, I think we should go to the studio. There wasn't, like, I think there was just a flat rate for being involved, whether you had already recorded the song or not. But we were in the studio with Mike already, and we were like, hey, can we, like, get a little deal to do a bonus track, do one extra? You know how those things go, and you never know how they're going to turn out. But I was excited to try to write an original, and it worked out. Yeah.
Well, this song is just, and I want to know, you know, you had mentioned before, you said I'm the least talented member of the band. I think you're being a little hard on yourself there. But with that said,
musically speaking, when you're talking about, like, jazz things happening and like polyrhythms and stuff. That's the other guys. Yeah.
well, that's what I was going to ask. So is your hand in this song lyrics and melody, or did you have anything to do with the music, or was the music brought to you from someone in the band?
With the Matches, I generally come in with a dumb guitar part that's easy to play on an acoustic that I write to, that we end up throwing out and completely replacing with other parts that we come up with together. But that serves as just the kind of like the demo, here's how the chord structure works. And oftentimes we don't even just like use the chords, but they're a good guide on what everybody, like what scales everybody will play at certain times or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that part is all collaborative, but yeah, I'll come in with a song that I can just kind of like ham fist out on an acoustic guitar that has the vocal melodies and lyrics and general chord structure. Yeah.
And do you remember the writing process with this one? How to go down?
I remember recording it better than I remember writing it, honestly. Mike Green had this studio in North Hollywood that he was just setting up, and it was just this big empty kind of loft space. There was crazy reverbs all around it. I think it must have been like, it was like a hangar. It was like, but not fancy. It was kind of a mess and sort of bad for recording. I remember we would make these like little spaces. Like there was like a hallway that had carpet in it. So that would be like the dry room, and we would just like hang bed sheets around it. Like he hadn't set up the studio yet. He just got it. And it was a huge space, and he had no money because he was just starting and had just moved to LA from the Bay Area to do this professionally. So yeah, we were kind of his guinea pigs in that studio, and he was like using this song because we weren't paying him much. He was using this song as sort of like a way of testing out the space and getting things to sound not terrible. So I remember experimenting a lot. And then we did use the big hangar room for like, I don't remember what exact reverbs we used in there, but we were like using like the sounds all around this place and just testing out mics in different places, which was really fun.
Was this track to Pro Tools?
I think he was on, at that point, he's on Pro Tools now, I'm sure, but he was on like Cakewalk, I think, at that time, okay. Which was, okay. What do you call it? DAW. It was a DAW like that. I don't think exists anymore.
for the listeners, a DAW is a digital audio workstation. So there he wasn't using Pro Tools, but he was recording digitally. He could chop parts up and move them around.
Yeah, we were playing with chopping. Yeah, yeah. You're hearing a little bit of that too, how the song is kind of stitched together. Yeah.
I kind of thought that it was recorded digitally and it wasn't done to tape, but I had to ask. And what was Mike's role in this song? Because, man, I got to tell you, this song was brought to my attention about a year ago. Chris has been wanting to get you on the show for a while now. We both have. And I heard this song and I was like, what did I just hear? It's so eclectic. And so like the parts rarely happen twice in this song. And how did this get off the ground floor? Like you presented the idea, you had I don't know what term you use. Was it lumpy acoustic guitar chords or whatever you bring into the band?
Yeah,
and all of a sudden it turns into, how did it get to this part, and what was Mike's role in that?
Like I said, he was trying to figure out what parts of his studio sounded good and what parts of it sounded bad, and what, you know, like trying to figure out a bunch of gear that he had just bought or borrowed and all this stuff. So it was like, you know, sometimes you walk into it, you go to a studio and it's, you know, you've paid for a certain amount of time and you're like, oh man, we got to get it done by 6 o'clock tomorrow. Otherwise we're over budget or whatever, you know, like there are those situations in studios. And this was not that. This was very much like, we're already working on a couple things and and our producer was like, okay, now let's try it over here. Now let's try it over here, and not charging us extra for that, which led to being able to experiment with like a lot of different sounds and a lot of different things. And I remember there's like a jangly like arpeggio thing that John DeVoto, our lead guitar player, does at a certain point in the song, and I like kind of vividly remember them being in like the big open room and like playing around with that part of the song. And I remember like walking in the room and being like, I don't even know where rhythmically this goes in the song. Like, are they playing the same song that I brought in? Like, I remember and then like Justin's bass part is like similarly doing a lot of like crazy walking around into like the sort of jazzy way. And I remember at certain times being like, Are they working on the same song I brought in? Yeah,
well, we're gonna get to that guitar part. Okay, you're talking cool. about, and it's so funny. It's so funny that you talk about being the guinea pigs, and he's trying to experiment in this new room. He just moved down from the Bay Area. He's trying to figure out his studio and figure out, you know, what sounds good, where the mics, where the sweet spots are.
Yeah,
that is so evident now when I listen to this song, because man, there's like 30 riffs in this thing. There's parts coming in and out. It's very, I'll use the word schizophrenic. It's kind of all over the place,
for sure.
But it works. It's such a cool piece of music. The song is 3 minutes and 29 seconds. For the first 3 seconds of the song, there's like this octave, just this cool octave guitar sound. And at the 4 second mark, you let out this like, this like soft shriek. I put my notes like, I don't even really know what you're saying there, but it's cool. At the 5 second mark, there's this chugging guitar that's swirling between the speakers. And then there's a guitar lick that's panned left and a guitar lick that's panned right. That almost sounds like a keyboard. This is happening while the drums and the bass are holding down this killer groove. And that guitar off to the right, I don't know if that's the one you're talking about. It's kind of like this arpeggiated thing. It almost sounds like something out of a horror movie, like Halloween or something. You know, and cool. I'm like, this is supposed to be a cheerful holiday song. This sounds eerie as hell.
Yeah, I think there's a nice tradition of like ghosts and horror seeping into the Christmas holiday. You know, we kind of like start to get stoked for the holidays when Halloween hits, sort of like marks the beginning of holiday season. And I love the like entertainment that you know, like Christmas Carol and like Nightmare Before Christmas. How just the holiday just kind of that season just sort of rolls into this one thing. So yeah, there is a little horror in there.
Well, and the first 24 seconds of this song is just like, what am I hearing and where is this going? And then all of a sudden you're into verse one at the 25 second mark.
Black flames to stare out, modeling slang to wear out, scuffed squares in sweaters, oh ho ho, we're so much better.
I'm going to read out these lyrics and I want you to decipher these for me and tell me what's going on.
Sure.
Black frames to stare out, Mod Lang slang to wear out, scoff at squares and sweaters, ho ho ho, we're so much better. What's going on in your sick, twisted mind, Sean?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of that Mike Park, I missed the bus energy here. But
I wouldn't have put those two analogies together, but okay.
No, I mean, Mod Lang was a record store that I shopped at in high school, and the staff there, they were older than me, they were cooler than me, they were like college kids, and maybe there was like an aspirational like, oh, when I get older, I want to be cool kind of thing that happened when I would walk into that store. I think that's why I dropped, like, I think it's also a truncation of modern language, so modern language slang or whatever. But I was thinking about the record store, I was thinking about the kids that worked at the record store, how I wanted to grow up and be one, and how I also like hated them. And so this whole song is just sort of like sort of a parody of not necessarily myself, but kind of who I wanted to be. I mean, it's kind of, I find it's kind of easiest to make fun of myself lyrically, and I do so whether I want to or not. I just like the recipe for being embarrassed by something that I write is just like, tell the truth, tell all of it, and then like wait 4 years, and then everything that I thought was cool about it is going to be embarrassing. So that's sort of what's happening in the entirety of this song.
Well, I like a good self-deprecating lyric. I'm a sucker for that. Now, the scoff at squares and sweaters, is that you scoffing at them, or are you making an observation, or are they scoffing at you and everybody else that's walking into the store because they're better than you?
No, I was thinking of Christmas sweaters, and I at this point, like I was still living in my parents' house. I was like you know, me and my friends were like starting bands and trying to get into art school and stuff like that. And you know, the romance of the holidays was sort of a rote thing that our parents did. Now, here's the footnote is that I love the holidays and I love romance, and I was going through a fuck this phase, but I knew that it wasn't going to age well. And so I was just writing a song in the moment, sort of making fun of my friends or who I thought I wanted to be or something like that. I think it's just in general, it at that age especially, it felt smart to be critical of something. So being critical, yeah, being critical of the holiday season felt fun and smart, but also just to tear something down and to be a critic is just sort of a lame, boring thing to do, and it's not creative, and it's actually not, it's not greatness, and it's not very smart. So,
well, that's what I'm taught. Say that's what I love about doing this podcast, because you could have told me 30 things of what this was about, and you know, it's I'm looking at these lyrics going, where is he coming from this? And it's great. This first verse here, the bass and the drums throughout, the bass is not staccato like the intro. It's moving. I wrote like in a circular fashion. It's kind of doing this round interplay. It's awesome. On the word scoff, there's this like slap echo that goes from left to right real quick. Remember what that was?
That's Mike Green right there. Yeah.
That's Mike. Okay, so that's something the producer came with. Okay, cool. It's just a little cool piece of ear candy there. I like that. And there's a double vocal, or I don't know if it's two backing vocals on the ho 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 part. That's the first time you hear more than one vocal there. And was there a reason that you stuck that there? Was that Mike's suggestion, or do you recall?
As much as possible. I mean, as much as possible, especially thinking about when you're writing a song, thinking about how it's going to translate on stage, you just know the parts where the other guys in the band step up to the mic are exciting and fun on stage, both visually from the audience. And it also tends to be, those tend to be lines that the crowd will be like, oh, everyone on stage is singing, I'll do it too. So part of like the experience of thinking about what this is going to be like playing it live kind of changes the way you approach this vocal arrangements, especially, I think.
Hey everybody, don't you dare go anywhere. There's lots more Krista Makes a Podcast after these messages from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities. From easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock, DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
Each week on the One Hit Thunder podcast, we welcome a special guest to come take a deep dive into a one-hit wonder artist with us. And together, we decide if that artist brought the one-hit thunder or was nothing more than a one-hit blunder. You can find One Hit Thunder anywhere that you listen to podcasts, so hit that subscribe button and join in on the fun each week. And now, back to the show.
Another reason I asked about digital recording Pro Tools was this is the first time the backing vocals, and it's throughout the song, that they're off time, the vocals. They're kind of disjointed. And I know that's on purpose. They weren't lined up perfectly. And it kind of gives you this kind of ragtag feel, you know?
Yeah.
And that made me go, wait a second, I wonder if this wasn't lined up because they were doing a tape, but it was too off. It sounded on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
At the 34 second mark, I'm not going to call this pre-chorus one. This part's so bizarre. I'm calling this interlude one because after the second verse, another interlude happens. I've never used the term interlude on this show before, maybe even ever in my life when describing songs. But this 34 seconds, this interlude between verse one and verse two, there's like the drums break down and the guitar brings in a brand new feel while the vocals are doing these kind of whoa, whoa, whoas.
So much better. Whoa, 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 yeah.
How did you write this part? Like melody wise, like where did this come from? Sometimes I look too linear at songs and I have to step back, but this is just like, where did this come from?
Sure. I always think of all the Who's down in Whoville during this part. Let me sing it. Yeah, the song didn't want to go into chorus yet. We'll get to the chorus the next verse, but I've been fairly wordy so far, so it needed a break. Sometimes you look to like a guitar solo and sometimes you just kind of make a musical interlude, and I guess we were all feeling it. So yeah, John kind of comes in with something different, and yeah, we orchestrated the vocals to do something different too. Yeah,
it's awesome. And you know, at the 44 second mark, you're now in verse two. The lyric is, used as the new black, downloads are the new crack, mocking carols that we hate, damn, it's easy being great.
Yeah. the line that's like the biggest cringe in the whole song, but also like heart of the whole song is, damn, it's easy being great. And it's so funny, you know, we'll still play this song in the holiday season, like for our reunion stuff. And it's so funny singing that I'm just like, I hope everybody knows, like, this isn't like, this is a parody. I hope that they don't see us on stage going like, damn, we are the shit, you know? And it's funny, but it had to be in here. It's the heart of the song too. So yeah.
No, it's awesome. The drums and the bass are holding down the same groove as verse one, but yet another guitar pattern is introduced here. You know, that interlude number one, you never hear that again in the song. And
yeah.
Now this guitar pattern now comes in verse two. And on the mocking carols that we hate, just on that one line, an octave guitar comes in here, kind of swirling left and right and back and forth.
Downloads are the new crack. Mocking carols that we hate. Damn, it's easy being.
Do you recall, was again, something Mike brought in or someone else in the band? Like, why just that one line and why that octave guitar there, which is awesome, though?
I know. I'm trying to think of, like, a lot of times when I write a song and I bring it to the band, I have a couple comps. Like, I will have been listening to a certain band and I'll be like, I'm thinking kind of like this meets this, you know? I honestly don't remember. When you're doing a song basically for a comp, you ask why this wasn't on a record. Well, like when you're doing a song for a comp, there's nothing to lose in being really creative, in stepping out on the edge and trying new things, because it's not going to go on your album. If you don't have the best song on a comp, people just skip your song or forget about it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not going to be a classic record.
That's so true. That's so true.
Exactly. So why not try stuff? And I remember that being the mentality. So I don't even know if we were thinking of other bands or things to borrow, or if we were just like trying to be weird and experiment. I'm sure I know you mentioned the guitars like almost sounding like synths sometimes. And that, I can say, probably came from, we had just done our first UK tour and that band Muse was getting popular over there, but hadn't hit in the States yet. And we were just like blown away by those, like by how his guitar sounded so weird and metallic and synthy sometimes. So I know John was like getting into a big Muse phase there.
Well, and that totally makes sense with what you were saying too, that you're able to experiment. This is just going on a comp. If no one likes it, we'll just skip
exactly,
it. Which,
exactly. Because
this is one of the more adventurous songs to me in your catalog. At the 54 second mark, we're at interlude number 2. Okay, not going to call this a pre-chorus. I call this the next interlude. Drums are doing the same feel as interlude number 1, but very soft on the kick and the ride cymbal. The guitar is doing yet another counter melody, another part, and there's this like la da 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 part vocally that's happening here. Then the band swells and stops abruptly before we're into chorus 1. So to hell with holiday romantics. December is for cynics. December is for critics. Let's get high on art supplies and hibernate. December is for cynics. Damn, it's too easy being great. You get that lyric in again there. And there's harmonies on everything here, but they're very disjointed, as I mentioned. And I wrote in my notes, it almost feels like a campfire sing-along. You know, you're kind of getting with your friends, it or a holiday sing along. It has that vibe to it. It's disjointed, but not in a bad way where you get a horrible band that can't play and like, oh, this sounds terrible. This was meant to be, obviously. It's perfectly disjointed. I think it's awesome. Again, there's a brand new feel here. It doesn't follow your traditional drum pattern of what you would consider. The drums are doing this just kick and snare. It's really interesting. And how did that come about?
Well, first of all, the gang vocals of the chorus was another, was us thinking about, hey, when we play this live, like this should be fun. And this feels like it wants to be a sing-along. I want to say that some of the guys from Over It might have been starting to work with Mike Green, and we met them somewhere around that time. And I think they came in the studio and sang these gang vocals with us. So you get that feeling of, you know, when you want to do a gang vocal, but like half of the room doesn't quite know the part.
Yeah.
And it ends up sounding kind of perfect. Like it's like everyone's sort of a little like, am I doing it right? Is that the rhythm? Is that the note? And it really like thickens up a gang vocal better than like if everybody was well practiced on a part. So sometimes it's like an asset to do a gang vocal with strangers or people that haven't heard the song, basically. So, yeah.
And what are you getting that lyric in again here? Damn, it's too easy being great. And you say it's too easy here, not just it's easy being great. bringing that lyric back and set up these lyrics for us here in the chorus.
If you hadn't like gotten sort of the theme of the too cool art school narrator me yet by this point, like this is, I guess the chorus is just sort of the Cliff's Notes on screw the holidays. This is going on a holidays on a holidays compilation. We're gonna be the song that's like screw this.
At the end here, at the end of the chorus, where damn, it's too easy being great on great, there's this hi-hat delayed weird thing off to the left. It's just like this it just happens for a second. It's too easy being great. And then there's like feedback, and I tried to Google this, Sean. I don't know, and maybe Chris can chime in here. What's it called when you take, I'll grab my guitar. Uh-huh. When you take, you know what I'm gonna talk about.
I know what you're talking about.
I don't know what this is called. When you hit this part of your guitar up by the neck.
Yep. That's what it is right there.
It's a pick rake, and that's there. And that
is that what it's that called? Alone, is it called a pick rake?
That's what I just called it. I don't know.
I think you're recording it here. Yeah.
Okay. So that comes in there, and just that tonality, that what I just played, that sounds eerie in and of itself. It's kind of sounds spooky and horror movie-ish.
Sure.
So that part comes in with a hi-hat and then the feedback, and we transition into verse number 3, which we're only at a minute and 29 seconds in this song, and you've been hit with a ton of information by this point, a ton of parts. And on this particular line, I feel like you were channeling Jello Biafra here almost.
I brought you a bottle of wine full of flowers and this vinyl. I know we both made it clear, no stupid presents this year. But snow's got chums and it's your place. Strawberry fields the wrong way. You can hear Lennon's ghost say.
You got like a little Dead Kennedys vibe going on. You say, I brought you a bottle of wine full of flowers and this vinyl. I know we both made it clear, no stupid presents this year. But Snopes.com said if you play Strawberry Fields the wrong way, you can hear Lennon's ghost say. And we're not going to go any further right now. I want you to set up those lyrics there and talk to me about channeling Jello on those first two lines. Was that subconscious, or were you a DK fan, or that just happened that way?
Yeah, I like the Dead Kennedys. I don't know the reference that I'm referencing at this point, but I might have been. What's the Dead Kennedys reference?
Well, it's the first two lines. It was just your vocal delivery of how you sang it.
Oh, of how I sang this, it. Oh, I thought
yeah,
you
it's like
lyrically.
I brought you about the. It's kind of like the, got vibrato in your voice that happens there.
Yeah. I mean, I love the Dead Kennedys, so that's cool. But I don't think I was intentionally doing that.
Okay. Awesome. I just thought that was really interesting because it was a different personality that comes out on those two lines that really isn't there in the rest of the song. Those two lines in particular, I brought you a bottle of wine full of flowers and this vinyl, those two lines in particular. The bass on the drums are holding down the groove, and the guitar is using like this delay tremolo sound and pattern from verse two. That has made it back. And when we get to the line, but Snopes.com said if you play, and through the rest of the lyrics here in this verse, there is a guitar run from the intro that comes in here on the left speaker. It's not the spooky riff at the top, it's the other riff.
But Snopes.com said if you play, Strawberry Fields the wrong way. You can hear Lennon's ghost say.
And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. Cool. I'm hearing something that I've heard in the song.
I'm finally hearing.
Yes. Yeah. Because up to this point, man, it is just all over the place in a great way. Not in a bad way.
Do you know what year this comp came out? I looked up when the song came out, and online seems to think when we added this to streaming services is when it came out, which is not the case.
It says 2003 on Immortal Records, which, as I said earlier, I believe was an imprint of Epic Records.
I have a theory, and I don't remember this specifically, but 2003 was when Blink-182 put out their untitled record, and the first song was Feeling This.
I'm feeling it, show me the way you move. I'm feeling it, it's such a blur. I'm feeling it, I love all the things you do. I'm feeling it, we fell short this time. Your smile fades in the summer.
And I remember feeling this knocking my socks off in terms of like this patchwork of like the drums are doing one thing and then doing something else. And then the vocals are doing that and the different vocal sound and a different part and a different part. I remember like being really enamored with how that song was like Pro Tools together, basically.
Well, I was shocked just from the fact I didn't know Snopes.com was around back then. I was like, geez, they've been around for over almost 20 years. Like that was what really shocked me about that this part.
Yeah. I like dropping that in there. It's fun.
And the lyric, I'll read this lyric again because it leads into the next part. But Snopes.com said if you play Strawberry Fields the wrong way, you can hear Lennon's ghost say. And I don't know if you ever looked up these lyrics online, Sean, but it's your first record. Yvonne Dahl killed the locals. Your first self-release record that was picked up and re-released by Epitaph. It says it's that backwards. Is that what that is there?
Lennon's ghost say.
Because
it's written, written backwards here in the online lyrics.
That is it. That's so funny. I thought what I say right after that in the lyrics is the Beatles line that is backwards on "I Am the Walrus," the "I buried Paul." So I answer that. You can hear Lennon's ghost say "I buried Paul," which was like, you know, just, I don't know. I don't know why I'm putting Beatles trivia into this song, but that's what I'm doing.
so that backwards line here, which is basically, I guess, Yvon Dahl killed the locals. You ran that backwards. It's kind of panned off to the left.
I forgot.
And it kind of sounds mumbled sounding, like, which is warbled because it's backwards.
Yeah,
it's backwards.
And then
then the very next line, you say, "I buried Paul."
Yeah.
How did that come into the, you know, December's for cynics, you know, December's for critics. You don't like the guy at the sweater at the record store. Now you're talking about the Beatles. What is going on here?
I mean, I got to say that, like, I like this verse better than verse one, just as a, just my songwriting brand. I like it when a song starts and it kind of, like, verse one is sort of like establishing the, oh, here's what we're doing here. There's the thesis for the song. And then the chorus hammers it home. And then by verse two, like, I got to meander off topic and, like, maybe I just need to, like, throw out verse ones and twos and just start with verse three, have that be verse one, and just throw out the first two things I read.
This is going on a Christmas comp. People are just going to skip it.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. But I actually like this one being so off topic. Whoever's listening to the song is going to be interpreting these things entirely differently. Like you said, the song could have been about 20 things. I had no idea. Like, it doesn't really matter. As long as I give you the right feeling and the right mood, like, and there are some cool lines to quote, like, it doesn't need to be so cohesive.
I mean, how many of our favorite songs are the most vague lyric and vague thing ever? And they, you know,
they just resonate.
This song is cool.
Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow, man.
At 1 minute and 54 seconds, we're at chorus number two.
Yeah.
So now with Holiday Romantics, December is for six. December is
So to hell with holiday romantics. December is for cynics. December is for critics. Let's go buy some takeout and hibernate. December is for critics. Damn, it's too easy being great. So there is a lyrical change here on line four. Let's go buy some takeout and hibernate. I noticed here, Sean, that there's harmonies pretty much throughout, but not on certain words. The harmonies were all over chorus number one and the gang vocal, I guess. But you say, so to hell with, and then holiday romantics, there's nothing on there. Do you recall why it was left off and it wasn't like chorus one?
That's a good question. My guess is that...
You had the channel muted?
Yeah, that could be it too. Could definitely be it.
Less than Jake's done that before.
My guess is that John actually might go into a unison part there. It wasn't until kind of like late era The Matches. It might have been even post The Matches that I figured out that harmonies are just chords that you're playing with vocals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I hadn't realized that, like, quite how to write a harmony. And I don't think John had either. We would just sing stuff and, like, you know, there are certain, you can, like, sing a third and you're like, that sounds good, but it doesn't always sound good. You can't just move a third with the whole thing, you know, like, you got to go with the scale. But I hadn't figured out that concept of it moving like chords and having to change the relative space between notes to stay in the scale hadn't occurred to me yet. So when something didn't work, oftentimes we would just sing a unison part or something.
Sometimes that's the only thing that does work.
Yeah, you know, totally.
You know, this chorus feels like chorus one, but the drums are doing completely different fills. There's some stuff going on here that's just really, really cool. On the line, let's go buy some takeout and hibernate. Between the words taken out, there's this crazy drum fill that just doesn't feel like it should work. It's like going off the rails. Like, where did that come from? Yeah. You know, it's not in chorus one. So again, talking about digitally recording through Pro Tools, a lot of times you'll paste chorus one and chorus. I'm like, this isn't the same feel as chorus, any of the choruses. Like, what right. the heck is going on here? But it's so great. I like on the last line here, damn, it's too easy. And then being great is just you alone. It just gives you that moment. It's just a vocal. And now we're into yet another part. And this bridge is awesome.
Is it being great?
At the 2 minute and 13 second mark, the drums are broke down almost a jazzy feel. Here's where it gets jazzy to me. This is a feel that not a lot of bands we were running with back then could have had this feel, you know. And I hearken back to what Brett said. These guys are rippers. When I first talked to Gurewitz about you guys, he's like, cool. The musicianship is through the roof. And I remember touring with you and watching you side stage. You guys were on fire. The guitar is doing like what I call volume swells. It's where like it sounds like a violin where the, you know, you're turning the volume up and down. I don't know if it was that or a volume pedal.
That's what it was. Yeah, really, that's what it was. It was a volume knob.
Volume. Yeah. It's such a cool effect. At the 2 minute and 23rd second mark, there's, I don't know if it's like a wah pedal with like a delayed flange guitar off to the left speaker. And then at 2 minutes and 32 seconds, the drums hit a more straightforward groove and the guitar off to the left is doing a high pitched lick while the guitar on the right is playing an octave lower counterpart to that. For the next 6 seconds from 240 to 246, there's three stop patterns, you know, where the band's like, you know, digga 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 dun, and it happens three times before this cool, fast guitar sweep happens to the left. And a sweep is something like Yngwie Malmsteen does, like, it's like this really fast arpeggio. You're like skipping strings, and it's just, I'm like, at this point in the song, I go, where did this come from? Like, who thought of this? It's off to the left. And that part, after that happens, it takes us into chorus three. But I love this bridge. You want to talk about taking you somewhere. This takes you on a little ride.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah. I know for the volume pot thing is a trick that I stole from Greg from Zebrahead, the guitar player from Zebrahead.
He was great at that.
Incredible guitar player and very innovative. He was like, you know, he was like a Muse caliber guitar player.
I think Greg tunes into this show sometimes. If you're listening, Greg, how you doing, buddy? I miss you.
Oh, Greg,
he's
I miss
awesome.
You too. Awesome.
Yeah, he is so
he's
awesome.
Incredible. And the stuff John is doing is like super Joe Satriani or Yngwie or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly. And I didn't even say arpeggiato guitar part because arpeggios to me are kind of like more like picking, but you can do fast,
right,
super.
Yeah,
I'm calling
this
what we used to call in the 80s a sweep. It's like, whoa. Like it's just, it came out of nowhere. And then we're into chorus number three, which is a double chorus here at the end of the song. So to hell with holiday romantics, December is for cynics, December is for critics. Harmonies on all of those lines, but it's only drums here. Again, the vocals are not lined up, sounds really disjointed, but really cool. Backyard campfire sing-along. The next line is just a melody. There's no harmony on this. Let's just try to sleep late and hibernate. Yet another lyric, new lyric. December is for cynics. Damn, it's too easy being. You don't say being great. You leave it hanging being. On that line, it's too easy being. The guitars come back in there. Prior to that, it was just the drums again. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a fake out almost before you get into the back half of chorus three here. In between, the first half has just drums. When it says December is for critics, before the new line here, let's just try to sleep late and hibernate, the guitar comes in here for two chords. Jing, jing, only. And then it goes back to drums, which I thought was really cool. Do you remember that part and how that came about?
You know, probably like channeling some Radiohead creep kind of to do something, you know, I don't know. Like, yeah.
Okay.
Those things are always fun when you're just like, when everybody pauses and something that like shouldn't be that musical happens. Those are always like hooks of moments, right?
Well, the last half of chorus three here, the back half. So to hell with holiday romantics. December is for cynics. December is for critics. Let's get by on NyQuil and hibernate. I love that line. December is for cynics. Damn, it's too easy being great. On the last line here, there's harmonies throughout everything I just read, even on the word damn, but then there's no harmony on it's too, and that's the last you hear of the rhythm section, the band going dun, dun, and then it's just you alone, Sean, saying easy being great, and that's how the song ends. Another little haunting sprinkle on top of this already haunting holiday song.
Yeah, sugar cookie it. Yep.
What was your reaction when you first heard this whole monster put together? You're in the studio, you're listening back to it. Was everybody into it, or was it just, it's going on a comp, people are going to skip it?
We were really excited about it. The last stuff that we had recorded in studio for Yvonne Dahl, Kill the Locals, I think we had just finished that stuff up the year before, maybe, and like the tail end of those sessions, we were, you know, when you get towards the end of an album, similarly, you can kind of start experimenting more. You don't have to be as safe. Like, you've got some songs you think are good, so you can be a little weird and see if something cool happens or if you ruin your record, whatever. But we had gotten into that and we had been able to play some of that stuff for an audience, and we're like, oh, they like the weird stuff, this is kind of cool, you never know, like, and so yeah. That kind of pushed us into this realm too, so we were excited, but we hadn't, I don't remember how long it was before we got to actually work out the live arrangement, because when you work in Pro Tools, sometimes things are so, like, you don't really have to worry about like which order you're pressing pedals in to get different sounds and stuff.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you have to go into the rehearsal space and like figure out compromises and ways to get from point A to point B in terms of guitar sounds and who could do what, and like, hey, can you play this thing from the bass line in the recording on your guitar so that I can switch over, you know, like, I remember that being a big undertaking with this song. Yeah. But when we actually got to play it live, we sort of get saved by the crowd on this one. Like, just when it gets to be like, we're like, oh my God, I can't, like, I can't compute. I'm gonna like got steam coming out of our ears, trying to keep the tones right and changing at the right time. And then it just gets to that, so to hell, and then the crowd just sings over us.
Takes
and
over.
We can all just kind of like, oh my God, okay, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, the last thing I want to finish up with here, I just want to tell you, I really feel like you guys were ahead of your time. I feel like you were really innovative. I hear hints and notes of your music still today. I heard it through the 2000s to even the 2010s, and now in the 2020s through bands such as Panic at the Disco, My Chemical Romance, Ice Nine Kills, and a number of other bands. I continue to hear flourishes of what I consider your sound, and you guys are awesome. If you could leave the listeners with what's going on. I know we talked a little bit at the top here, but what's going on with you coming up or the matches?
Yeah, and for me, I still do music. I do solo stuff. My solo project's called Saint Ranger. It's ST period space Ranger. And you can find me on Instagram with I have a record club called Pretend Record Club, where me and my friend Tim DeVille take turns producing each other's tracks. So if you're all about, and each one of them gets sent out as vinyl. So it's kind of a quarterly thing that we do biannually. And then, beyond that, the matches, we've written an album and we're arranging it, and we'll see if we ever record it. Got to see what Mike Green is up to these days, but maybe new stuff, or maybe we get back together and do whatever anniversary is coming up in 5 years. You know, there's always one.
I'm gonna do an online petition to get a Santa Claus. It's a Punk Rock Christmas Part Two. Okay,
awesome.
You gotta write the sequel. You gotta write the sequel to this one. All right,
sounds good.
Awesome, thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Chris. That was really fun.
Hey, everybody, don't touch that dial. There's plenty more Chris to Makes a Podcast after a few words from our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're looking for an inexpensive and unique gift for a friend, family member, or even for yourself, check out iloveenamelpins.com. From Hollywood stars like Jeff Goldblum and Meryl Streep, to fictional characters like the Golden Girls or Jack Torrance, to sports stars and musicians and politicians and dogs and cats, there's something for everyone at iloveenamelpins.com. As an added bonus, use the discount code ChrisDemakes at checkout to save 30% off your order at iloveenamelpins.com.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for ChrisDemakes, a podcast, all you have to do is email your song via MP3 only and your bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is The Thieves About from San Diego, California. They're a high-energy rock band consisting of J. Scott Gavin on vocals and guitar, Brian Ullery on drums, John Reichs on guitar, and Andrew Williams on bass. Here's a snippet of their song, We Go Down.
I know the ropes to make it right.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Oh boy, was I excited for that episode. As you know, Chris, I've been wanting to do a December is for Cynics episode forever. I'm not lying when I say it's my favorite holiday slash Christmas song ever, even though it's kind of, in a way, making fun of the Christmas season, but I just think this song rocks.
This song is, in everything that Sean said, down to this producer, Mike, he got a brand new place, he moved from the Bay Area to LA, he was trying to figure out what sounds good. I mean, everything that he was talking about lended itself in. The song's just going to be on a comp. If people don't like it, they can skip it. It led to this being the monster that it is. I took so many notes in this song. It took me forever to get through them, I felt, in the episode. It was so much here.
Yeah, it's a monster of a song. And I love The Matches, and I feel like my band Punchline has a lot of parallels with them. I recently saw their documentary called Bleeding Audio. It's great. It's awesome. As you brought up in the episode, Chris, I feel like this band was very popular, but I feel like they could have been even way more popular just based on, yeah, I think maybe they were a little bit ahead of their time in certain aspects.
I do too.
Whatever. All that stuff aside, I felt like a lot of similarities in our band's story. And much like he was saying, Punchline got asked to be part of this same comp. And we were like, oh, hell yeah. We saw the list of bands that were going to be on it. Oh, Blink-182's on this. Oh, all these, like, the Mighty Mighty Bosstones are on this. This is amazing. But we got asked to be on it, but they were like, yo, you got to submit your song in, like, 3 days. So we wrote a song and went to a studio and recorded it. And it is the most patchwork song ever. And it's called Ice Schools. Yet fans of ours love it. When we listen to it, we're kind of like, oh my God, we threw that thing together so fast. And it's just like a patchwork of things. And it kind of sounds similar to what The Matches did here, although I think The Matches song is way better than ours.
Well, he kind of echoed those sentiments too, that kind of like, eh, it was just this song for a comp. It was kind of like, yeah, we patched this together in this guy's new studio. And that's why I asked him. I said, when you heard it back, do you like the song? He's like, oh yeah, we still play it. The audience loves it. It's great when we get to the chorus. So I'm glad he's embraced it, because at first it was just like, it almost was like, wait, is this a throwaway song for these guys? How could it be?
Dude, I was laughing because I know everyone out there listening can't see you guys, but the whole time Sean was smiling and laughing. I think he felt that he referenced it. He said, I got that I missed the bus Mike Park energy, referencing the Mike Park episode where Mike was kind of like, oh, you're bringing up this cringeworthy old song or whatever, like, where he felt embarrassed. But like, I'm thinking to myself over here, dude, I've been rocking this song out this week. There is nothing cringy about this song at all. I feel like it rocks. I feel like you were asking him a lot about, like, what does this mean? And when I listen to this song, I don't know if I just take away my own meaning. I do get that it's kind of parody. I picture, like, the guy in the black turtleneck and glasses who's too good for Christmas. Dude, I almost think about, you know, in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her husband who, like, live next door and they, like, have whatever. They don't celebrate Christmas. They have, like, the black Christmas tree or whatever. I picture those characters.
He falls and breaks his neck.
I'm sure he'll fall, but I don't think we're lucky enough to have him break his neck. Let's go.
But I get it. I love the verse about, like, hey, you and your significant other saying, hey, no stupid presents this year. We're going to listen to records and we're going to hang out. And I just think, as me being somewhat of a Scrooge about the holidays, I just, like, relate to this song and I love it.
Yeah, no, I don't. It's really interesting. I've had that a number of times, not just Mike Park. There's been other times on this show. And when I talk to bands on the road or friends and people I meet and just like, hey, I really like that lyric. Like, what? I wrote that in the back of my van when I was drunk one night. That's a lame lyric. You know, there's nothing to be embarrassed about in these lyrics. And, you know, I take away kind of the literal meaning, kind of as you did. But at the same time, I asked him those questions. What are you saying here? Because I was trying to get in his mind of who's the squares and the sweaters here? Is that you or is that them? And I loved how he started to describe it. It was great.
I loved that he said, I hope everybody knows this is parody. But that lyric is the heart of the song. And man, the Matches had such a cool, I don't know, image about them and such a cool energy and vibe to their band. You know, songs aside, if you looked at the guys or saw them live, someone could have thought that, like, oh, this lead singer, this band, he's going to be an asshole or whatever. This was the nicest, most humble dude.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
When I was watching this, like, I told him this after we finished recording. I'm like, I feel like I'm friends with you and I want to be friends with this guy. He's like the nicest dude, like the complete opposite of maybe this character that he portrays somewhat in the songs or whatever. It's just not him. It's so humble, you know?
No, and it's funny. I haven't talked to Sean in probably 13 or 14 years, and it was like we picked right back up, and you know, we're back in a dressing room on tour 14 years ago. He's just, they were always such great guys, and I was careful about the words I chose earlier. You know, it's, you never know what's going to strike a nerve with somebody. Like, your band should have been bigger, but I just feel this band, we're so ahead of their time, and more people should know about them. They're great.
I agree with that, but also they're a pretty popular band.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Know, like in their time, yeah. Like they did well.
Absolutely,
you know. So
absolutely,
I think about that all the time. You know, when I'm thinking about my own band or whatever, is like grass is always greener. And when it comes to that sort of thing,
sure.
You know. And sometimes if I'm down on myself, like oh, I wish my band was bigger or whatever, I got to think about the fact that like, oh wait a second, my band has achieved more success than probably 99% of bands ever.
Oh yeah, and
so,
and the Matches are in that department as well. They for sure had and seeing them live back then, the audience went crazy for them. They were rabid for them. They had a great live show, and no, they made it in the sense of hey, did your band make it? Yeah, these guys made it. But I feel that more people should have known about it. I think they're just an amazing band.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also, Chris, one more thing I wanted to talk about was, and I think about this in songwriting too, but Sean brought up thinking about, hey, this is going to be fun to sing live, like with the audience when you're writing
yeah.
and recording something. I know Less Than Jake has to do that, right?
There's been times, mostly in the early stuff, but you know, before, because we were writing songs that were taken straight from the warehouse to the stage. We weren't recording them.
Right.
So it was definitely in the early days more thought of in that sense. Wait, this is going to be a great sing-along.
And no doubt this chorus in December is for cynics. I haven't seen the Matches play this live in person, but you better believe I'm going to have chills from head to toe and be singing along so loud if I ever have the pleasure of seeing this song live.
And speaking of chills from head to toe, Chris, I cannot wait to announce next week's guest. I am stoked.
I know you can't. I know you can't, but you got to hold off a few more days. I know you're ready to tell the whole world about this one. I know you've been waiting for this one for a long time, but you got to keep it a secret for a few more days, Chris.
I know. I'm like a kid at the holidays. I got to tell you, last year for December, we had the holiday special with the Vandals. We had Joe Escalante on, which was a lot of fun. And this year, we've done two. We had Sean with the matches with December is for Cynics, today's episode. But next week, we have another one. We're doing a two for this year, Chris.
Yeah, you consider next week's a holiday one, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. Kind of. the tail end of the episode, we're going to get into it. But yeah, okay. Man, it's been a lot of fun. I can't believe we're about to wrap up another year, going on 2 years now. Next June of 2022, it'll be 2 years of this podcast. I don't know where the time has went, but it's been an absolute blast.
You have been doing a great job as host of this podcast, Chris, because I got to say that I know it's not easy to get on the podcast. Okay, maybe it's a little easier when it's somebody you've known for a long time, it's your friend, and it's not so hard. But when you get on here with someone you don't know, and you instantly have to break the ice and then dive into some piece of art that they've created from their heart and really like get into the nuts and bolts of it, that takes a lot, man. Not everyone can do that. So I commend you very highly for that.
Well, I appreciate this, Chris. Your check's in the mail. I to be honest with you, I've only had, out of all these episodes we've done in the last year and a half, there's only been maybe one or two hiccups where it's been a little weird, and that's to be expected. You know, just because guys are in bands, or you know, people are in bands, they're the front people a lot of the time that I talk to, they're not always the alpha male or female. Sometimes they just are awkward, and it's hard to talk to people. Luckily for me, most people have been very engaging and easy, but there has been a couple hiccups, but I'm glad there hasn't been any more than that.
Yeah, but I like what we're doing. I'm glad we're going to keep on doing it into the new year and onward and upward, and I'm excited for what we have coming in the new year too, man. But hey, I'm focusing on the moment now. We are in the thick of the season. Tis the season, man.
Tis the season. We hope each and every one of you out there are safe, happy, and most importantly, sane this time of the year. We'll see you next week. I want to thank this week's guest, Mr. Sean Harris from The Matches.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.